Tonight we're talking about uses and abuses of our natural resources. And we're very fortunate in having two people who are professionally engaged in making decisions about precisely that. Most of you met both of these people, I suppose, by this time. But on my right is Dick Buescher, who is in the regional office of the Forest Service in Portland. Has been a person who's been involved with Holden almost as long as I have, I think, Dick. And has been very helpful. He was the regional person for the Wenatchee Forest, the Wenatchee Forest Office when we first started here. He's in Portland now. I say he's going up, he says he's going down. His theory of office management is that the guy at the top, what I would call the top, the guy at the bottom, he thinks supports the other people. So that's an interesting administrative theory. Anyway, we're delighted to have Dick here tonight. Tom, you probably all attended some of his sessions already, is a geologist by trade, but recently he has been working with, he calls it the Wisconsin Geological Survey, is that right? And works largely with, I think, minerals and mines, in helping the state of Wisconsin decide what may and what may not be mined, just like Mr. Buescher works with the question of what uses are to be made of the forest areas, especially for recreation. Isn't that right, Dick?
Really for everything.
Yeah, for everything.
Right now, in my emphasis area is wilderness and recreation, but you can't extract that from everything else.
What we're going to look at tonight is how do you make the sort of almost immediate decisions about what are you going to use next year and 5 years from now and so forth. And I don't mean to ignore the longer range on that, but it's the allocation of natural resources for sort of, may I call it short-term use, realizing that what we do with the forest today obviously has impact on what our grandchildren will do too. But it's the allocation and decision about how we go on making decisions about how much timber to cut and so forth and how much mining to do. Tomorrow night also talks about the resources, the planet on which we live, the future of our earth, but it's going to be focused primarily on those questions which are driving all of us crazy. The greenhouse effect and those problems which are inescapable, they've got to be met and answered some way, and at the moment they seem to be largely unanswerable. And the crew that will be working the forum tomorrow night are people who are engaged in those questions. scientists who are engaged in both the physical and the ethical questions of how do you get at those long-term problems of our world. This forum, as we always do, will be done by having our two experts here make short statements about the problem of using and abusing our resources and how those decisions are made, and then we will open it up to a general conversation. Who would like to talk first?
Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, would you like to put this on, Tom?
Put it on?
Oh, talk at it or something. Is anybody using one of these? Not. These are the little amplifiers. If nobody is using it, why, we won't use it either. Okay? Excuse me, Doctor.
Well, what I was going to make some comments on, to, from my perspective, is to talk a little bit about my observations about the effectiveness of public involvement in making decisions about the use of resources. And I hope that that's in line with where we want to go, and I hope that it'll be of some interest. In the course of my work, I have watched the state of Wisconsin develop a regulatory framework for mining in the state, and I have watched, as it has developed that framework, a considerable number of publics be involved in that process in different ways. I'm not going to get into how all the different ways, but I was going to make, just for hopefully that it might stimulate some controversy, is to talk to you about how I see the effectiveness of the public involvement in those decisions. And feel free to take exception with what I say, because I'm not going to be too kind. There are two different types of decisions I see that are being made in a resource arena when we talk about short-term allocation of resources. Let's say it's a decision about projects. Should we open this mine or not? Should this mine be allowed to go forward or not? Should we build this nuclear power plant or not? Should we build this dam or not? These are decisions which involve allocation of resources, which are relatively things that we make and over the course of a year or so of intensive discussion. And I would like to say that when we talk about decisions on projects, that the public involvement tends to be very ineffective. Usually the technical issues are fairly clear cut, where most of the technical people who have knowledge of the area have some general broad-based agreement on what the technical ramifications are. And oftentimes the public doesn't know much about the technical end of it and fail to educate themselves on the technical end of it and try to make technical comments. And they are generally very ineffective. When you go in front of a hearing examiner, for example, when you have a hearing on a permit, the public's comments about the technical effect, the technical aspects of a particular project generally falls pretty much on deaf ears. Because the hearing examiner knows that that person has no real technical expertise and they'll tend to listen to so-called experts. I'm not saying this is good or bad, I'm just saying that this, I think, is the way it is. But what is effective about public involvement on a project is a feeling. When a person from the public gets involved and says, I don't like the thought of this mine going in here, I object to it, I don't like the thought of a nuclear power plant being built in this area, I don't want nuclear power generation facilities near me or my kids being raised near me, the feelings, I think, can be very effective. Particularly if those feelings are connected into a regulatory structure which would allow that, you can influence local authorities by saying, well, I'm going to vote that guy out if he supports that permit process. That can be very effective, but in general, in terms of a decision on a project, when the public tries to be technical, I think they're very ineffective. The other category of decisions that I see a lot of are decisions that are more broad-based policy, regulatory framework kinds of questions. Should we adopt these regulations for groundwater quality control, or should we adopt something else over here for surface water quality control? Again, the public is generally ineffective because they tend to be technically ignorant. It's hard for them to make technically effective comments in an arena like that. And they need to be effective, good technical representation. They can get their viewpoints across when we're developing regulatory frameworks very effectively if they go out and hire technical representation or legal representation or both. They can be effective in that arena. Again, because the decision makers are making value judgments about everybody's input. And so what I see a problem with is we make decisions about short-term allocation of resources, whether we should open mines or not open mines, this kind of thing, is that the public's involvement is often a problem. It just doesn't seem to me to be very effective, and yet they are the ones who are oftentimes most directly affected by the project. And I make that observation, and maybe you can react to it, or that's not your experience, or maybe we could talk about what can be done to correct that.
You just launched me. You'll hear a different view. But I also have operated in a somewhat different arena. Throughout my career, I've been thrown into a lot of very controversial planning tasks, and I'll compare two of those, one that worked well, one that did not. But before I do that, I'll tell you that I worked for the people that own the place, okay? The 192 million acres of the National Forest are owned by the public, the United States. It took the agency a long time to learn that. And we used to speak with a strong possessive interest, which is nice. I used to talk about my mountain when I talked about Mount Hood when I was a ranger there. But in fact, it didn't belong to me. That was nice, but to a fault. We felt so possessory in our early history, and I go back 32 years, in the Forest Service, that in fact we did not seek public counsel and had the opinion that ranger knows best. Recent times and discontent by publics for a variety of reasons on how their national forests were being used and allocated caused a lot of things to happen. Fundamental to that was a change in the law. All decisions made in the National Forest, any other federal agency, are made if they have a significant impact on the human environment within the context of the National Environmental Policy Act. And that requires effective communications with the public. I think the agencies in natural resource allocation and decision making failed miserably in the early years of implementation of NEPA, and I, as an author of NEPA statements, I completely guilty to that. We fail miserably to communicate technical subjects to the lay owners. That is an obligation under the law. It's also a very professional obligation. I don't think it's sufficient to say if they can't bring a technical argument, we can't hear them. Because the public has had a very good friend called the judge who has said that a NEPA statement must communicate. If it fails to communicate, it will fail a test in a court of law. So we had to learn to communicate. And to communicate, you gotta listen. And agencies did not listen. Probably the greatest anomaly is the title of a process that Tom referred to called a hearing, when in fact there is a great deal of deafness at most hearings. Fortunately, the Forest Service doesn't use a hearing process. We use interaction with people, and we've gotten, I think, pretty good at it. I'll give you a case in point on how effective the public can be. In the 10-year history of my period on the Wenatchee as a deputy supervisor, we have an administrative appeals process where anyone with a 22-cent, now 25-cent stamp can say, Ranger, I don't like your proposal for that timber sale next year, and I appeal on these grounds. The appeals process was only used, and we offer, in the case of timber sales, many other actions, but in timber sales, over 100 offerings a year off of this 2.5 million acre forest. The appeals process was only used 3 times in my 10 years. That was the lowest number of appeals in the history of any forest in Region 6 in that period, and there are 19 forests. My pride is not in that fact. My pride is in the fact that in all three cases, we changed the sale because the appellant, that non-technical input to our sale, was damn good sense, you should excuse the expression. And so we agreed and altered the sale. My two cases, the North Cascades, I was thrown in to answer the question of Senator Jackson, if the Forest Service keeps the 700,000 acres from this ridge right up here to Canada, how well they manage it. We were proposing National Recreation Area, but that was very ambiguous. So they threw me in, and in 6 months I put a terribly site-specific development plan for the North Cascades together. But the two agencies were squabbling in what was called a Blue Ribbon Committee set up by President Kennedy. And rather than working professionally to come to a consensus of advice on where a national park should be placed up in the North Cascades, which of course had to be extracted from the national forest system, the territorial protection went on. Forest Service saying, we don't want a park, we can do better. Park Service saying, we'd like to have it all, and we're not going to compromise anything. And obviously, and the public in the meantime saying, wait, we'd like to tell you what we would like, and neither agency was listening. Neither the Department of Interior or the Department of Agriculture, representing the two agencies, were listening. And so Senator Jackson carved the place up. He did what we elect officials to do, act when the agencies fail. And I can tell you it's all in the wrong place, and I drew the boundaries for them. So, just 6 years later, I came back to the mountain south of here in the Alpine Lakes case. In that case, everything was different. We were not dealing with two agencies in contest, but we still had that enormous question. How much should be wilderness? How much should be not of a million acre area outside of Seattle? And we listened to the public. The timber industry formed a coalition with other user groups who thought differently and thought of more than just cutting trees. The environmental communities behaved responsibly and went to school and found out what the alternatives were really all about, including managing timber, and compromise was struck because agencies and citizens worked together and the Congress had an extremely easy job. The congressman and I sat down in a room and wrote a law that was passed without appeal and without legal contest. So I believe, from my experience, it will work when the agencies truly want to include the public in the process. So I'll quit there.
I listened with great interest to Tom and Dick disagreeing with each other, and it finally occurs to me that they're both wrong. And I know it's not the moderator's position to take an argument with the two panelists, but for what it's worth, if I understood Tom correctly, he said in essence that the public is usually not very effective when it appears at a hearing because it doesn't hit the public. The people don't have the information and knowledge that they need to make an understandable kind of argument. If that's wrong, Tom can tell me about it later. Dick said in essence that the service didn't do so very well until it really started listening to the public about things like the sale of timber and the recreational uses of the area, and then it did better when it did elicit meaningful information from the public and got a better act out of it. I understand that argument, and it's an interesting one, which you can react to. But the part that bothers me is that neither of them spoke at length, at least, about how about the grandkids. And I think that's within the range. Or maybe that's implicit in what you're saying. But it's one thing to have the person who wants to buy the timber this year come in and say, I don't like the way you set it up for sale. Or the person who wants to mine the minerals this year say that. But who in this process represents the next generation? How do you represent people who aren't born yet? Maybe that's the job of Congress, or maybe that's the job of the state of Wisconsin or somebody else, but I think we ought to get that into the equation too. Now, before they start throwing bricks at me, what's your reaction to this? You know, how should the public get into the hearing process or the appearance before the service, the Forest Service, to see to it that they are doing what we ought to do with our natural resources? Or do you think we ought to just let them go their own way?
Question is who's to decide what we ought to do.
When I heard you say that the Forest Service and the National Park Commission were arguing back and forth, it seemed to me that they was arguing more for budget. Isn't that true?
Not. There are times when that was true. In the case, in that case, it's more territorial than that. It's a very great difference in philosophies of the two agencies. We have two entirely different missions. The National Forest Service, born in 1905, has a mission from Congress in law to practice wise use of the national forest. Okay, the greatest good for the greatest number in the long run is in the letter from Secretary Wilson to Gifford Pinchot, but Gifford Pinchot wrote the letter in the first book. Very artful leader. So use, wise use, sustained use over time of those resources, not utilization without renewal for those that can be renewed. The National Park Service, created in 1916, or got their Organic Act in 1916, their mission is to preserve natural ecosystems for the enjoyment of the American people. Two entirely different missions. And so, for the National Forest Service, we strongly believe in ours, and the only place you make a national park is out of a national forest. Okay? or you go out and buy somebody's land, but it's usually not suitable for a national park in the first place. So, obviously, we're always giving, and they're always taking, and so that creates a very natural and understandable relationship that is not full of love at the national level. At the local level, the relationships are marvelous. We share people, training, vehicles, all kinds of things. Offices. So, the but you got to understand, those are two very different polarized views of what's right. It isn't really budget. It's far more than that. It's principles. We believe we can do a better job. And we believe we have been doing a better job, or otherwise, why in the world would they want to make a national park out of the national forest if we haven't done such a good job of being a mess?
I thought it was all one group.
Oh, no, two different agencies, two different departments. Department of Interior, Department of Agriculture. That's why we're in agriculture. Utilization. When you talk wilderness, whole new subject, we'll do that at 10:50 tomorrow. Because that transcends the agencies. Wilderness overrides both. And two other agencies.
You want to get in this one before we go back?
No, that's right. I think that's
okay.
That's
the sawdust people worry about that, and you worry about the minerals. Right?
However, we worry about minerals too.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Use.
Yeah, I don't know how other people feel, but to me it seems that you have people that are concerned about a particular thing, whether it's a mine or whether it's some aspect of logging or whatever, and because of ignorance, a lot of times I couldn't care less what's going on. So then that's what first came to mind, and so I think right from the start one of the basic problems is ignorance. That is, people don't know a lot of times that there is an issue. They don't know what the issues are associated with a mine opening or closing. Our media, that is the newspapers that I read in New Mexico, typically are not capable of explaining to me what the issue is. I think I would honestly say that most of the media in our country is not very good. So where do I go to, and how is it communicated? There is so much information that is thrown at us. What do I accept? And it's very frustrating.
So for you, a hearing is really not very helpful.
No.
In the hearing process.
I mean, I need to be educated that I wouldn't be there. I need to be educated ahead of time.
See, that's the difference in the approach we take. We don't hold hearings by practice. We only hold hearings for wilderness because wilderness law requires it, but they never become a functional part of the decision. That's just a process that you go through and a record is keeping and nobody ever reads it. But we realize that, and so we take on public education before we face the public with the position of having to recommend. Now, when that's through the NEPA statements, we did a very poor job of writing a volume that the public could be expected to even take the time to consult. That's what we've had to break down. So we break it down into sessions like this. This forest, like every forest in the United States working on its forest plan now, they probably had no less than 500 sessions with groups large and small all over the three counties they represent and in King County in Seattle, just to get dialogue on the forest plan. And that is the long term. The most familiar phrase, and I suspect Tom hears it too, in any, however you receive your communications, is for our children's children. Okay? So it is always put in that context. In fact, all of our decisions are long term. One timber sale, if it clear cuts a timber, has made a decision about an ecosystem forever. Think about it.
Yeah, but who decides what's good for the grandkids?
Well, that is the forest planning process. That's an immediate 10 plus 50. So, and that also is under law, under the 1976 Forest Management Act. And so, in fact, that is a long-term commitment of resources. See, it's all planning of resource, all resource planning, all planning. But resource planning, your own budget is resource planning, is dealing with issues of supply and demand, whether they be minerals or timber or wilderness.
That's what they are, and they are finite resources. This country, 50 years ago, believed they were. They thought they were infinite. That's how we behave, as if our resources were infinite. They are not.
Let me throw a wrinkle in here, just for the sake of maybe adding another aspect or dimension to it. The resources that Dick is talking about are owned by the public. Many of the resources that I am familiar with in those decisions are privately owned. The minerals are owned by some landowner, perhaps it might be a mining company, it might be a landowner who leased to a mining company and wants to see those resources developed. And I would submit that that makes a tremendous difference in how we go about involving the public ultimately in that decision. Because I think the public's right to participate depends on whether or not they are in fact stakeholders in the ultimate decision. Now, I'm not going to say that the public has no stake in a decision, say, about a mining operation. Don't get me wrong. But I'm saying that their stake is significantly different than it is on publicly owned lands, using publicly owned resources.
Except that in your one, in the one resource area that we share, minerals, because of the 1872 Mineral Act and others that followed, as soon as a legitimate prospect is found, then the mineral is not the possession of the United States, but becomes the possession of the finder. A curious anomaly in the law that was written in the 1800s to encourage this country to find its very important mineral resource and encourage exploration. There are many that think that law is out of date and that minerals should be like timber. Except where entry is excluded, wilderness now, after the passage of December 31st, 1984, till that time even wilderness could be entered legitimately for mineral purposes. Mining becomes, or potential mining, minerals that are an economic chance to mine are taken from the public domain by discovery and application and meeting the requirements, the work requirements of the Act. So they are moved from the public domain. So in that case, we're exactly the same. They become the ownership of the person or company.
Well, let's explore that by taking a hypothetical, but kind of a case that we could all see. Let's suppose that this is a lake out here in the middle where the dirt is, and that each of us own a piece of land going around here. Now, theoretically, as I'm sure all of you people know, that your ownership runs to the middle of the lake in sort of a pie-shaped thing like this, and the water runs over the top of the small point down there, and we all own the part around here. The state of Washington's done something about this recently, which brings the case to mind. Suppose that I want to build out over the water on stilts, so that pretty soon we could reduce the size of the lake, maybe cover it all together with a little luck if we each decided to build out there. Now, if it's private ownership, do you think that, well, I made us all owners, you just lost your interest. We up here own around the lake. You people are the rest of the people who live in the community. Should you have some voice about whether or not we cover up the water out there?
Well, my vote on that lake. Dick says, I have a feeling about that.
Yeah, I want to be able to fish it. I don't want it all covered up. I want to be able to go out there.
Does it make a difference to you whether or not we call that private property or public property?
Whether or not the water can actually be private property.
And you mentioned groundwater earlier on, and the water that's trickling around underneath the surface is...
Your example, I'd like to... I mean, you obviously know Washington, but...
No, that's totally hypothetical. That can't happen in Washington.
Well, it can't happen in any
no.
state...
Department of Natural Resources owns everything in the
It can't happen in any state that I'm
no,
aware
I don't,
either,
I,
because usually
I don't
that
either.
Water is
yeah.
held in public trust.
Right.
And oftentimes, the bed of that lake is publicly owned anyway.
That's correct.
And
yeah, see, right down here on Lake Chelan, which is National Forest until you get to just short of Moore Point, then you enter the National Park. But neither the National Park or the Forest Service own the land under the high water mark. The Department of Natural Resources does. When we put the dock at Fields Point, we had to buy a permit from DNR to put that dock in and get permits from 17 agencies. We did. So, you know.
I have a question about this. I've always wondered about. You can imagine a situation where a person doesn't do anything, doesn't put anything out in the lake. Let's say somebody who has control of the land, puts up houses all the way around the lake and basically makes it impossible, because in order to get to the lake you're going through private property, makes it impossible to have access to the lake. And I think that has happened. So is that some kind of trick in the law, or?
Well, again, in the state of Washington, you know, there's powerful law to protect that. It's a Shorelands Management Act.
Okay.
It was written for a case on this lake. And in fact, you can drive to it today and you'll see they created artificial moorings and they've never been built on because they put a hold on them. They got a court order to stop it, and it was a case here and a case of condominiums on Lake Washington. The two co-mingled, and we got the Shorelines Management Act, one of the most powerful shorelines protection acts in the United States. So, you know, we're probably straying from the subject too, but we're talking about something that is very germane to the subject. It's, you know, what I always refer to as the Commonwealth, okay, an English term, but it is wealth, the natural resources of the nation held in common by the people. Matters of the Commonwealth must, in allocating that do affect our children's future, must include expressions from the public before decisions are made. That to me just makes sense, because it's Commonwealth. It's as if we were all stockholders or in an investment club, we would want to have a voice. I'm interested in you, though. I want to know how many people here have tried to participate with any government agency. Not, you know, not necessarily people Tom and I represent, Forest Service, or anybody else. How many people go to school board meetings? Why do you go?
I used to be on the school board.
Yeah, so did I.
So I've seen it from both sides.
How about you?
I'm a teacher.
Okay, so you go with the team. Yes.
Agency hearings.
You go to agency hearings. How do you feel about your participation in agency hearings? Do you feel like your voice is heard?
Not much.
Why?
My feeling that the congressmen go from place to place and they're impassioned pleas on both sides and come up with kind of a draw. I don't know how they make their decisions.
I'll give you an insight from one experience I had about it. But first, others. Any others? They don't feel ashamed, because the majority of our people do not involve themselves. Yeah. Oh, a personal one?
Yeah,
they're
bigger than I was.
Well, that's a lose-lose situation. Talk about not listening. Well, see, you're sort of typical. Public involvement, hearings are something of a fraud, in my view, because they're sort of just a setup, and that's why we don't have hearings. And I said that earlier. But when you get into public involvement in a supply and demand question, how much wilderness should we have? We did that in 84 in this state. Idaho and Montana are still in the throes of it. The laws, their state laws, have not been passed. And when you get into that, it's an adversarial relationship, automatically, that brings you to the place. If you're ambivalent on the subject, why would you go? You have better ways to spend your time. The people that are ambivalent are usually the ones most affected. The ones that show would be a timber industry in the case of a wilderness question, because they're trying to protect their potential profits in timber supply. The wilderness people come because, of course, they want to use the Wilderness Act, not necessarily to create wilderness, but to stop the trees from being cut. So we hear very polarized opinions if we just held hearings on the subject, and it's totally predictable. It's not an elective process. There is no machinery in the United States to do these things by election, fortunately, because we don't even do well with how we use our votes in an election, I feel. So we wouldn't on natural resource issues. We get less exposure to those than we certainly do to the presidential candidate. And yet, we need the communications. So we feel the only way is education.
But isn't that
to make it interesting.
Isn't that Tom's point exactly?
But I say you can overcome that. I had 10,000 responses on the Alpine Lakes. One gentleman named John Ware, city employee in the city of Seattle, sat down and wrote a 17-page paper In those 17 pages, he had one short paragraph. That short paragraph said, I believe that when you drew your proposed boundary through Altruis Lake, which in fact was a wetlands, that was foolish because you cut an ecosystem in half. I believe you should move it to include the entire ecosystem.
What was his interest? Why did he write the letter?
Because he was a hiker. He used the country.
We've got one segment of the population that's responding.
Okay, but let me make this point. We moved the boundary. 10,000 people responded. John Ware had an observation. In anybody ecosystem. John Ware just thought that wasn't very smart. He'd been there. Why not put it all in? He was right. We put it all in. It's not an elective contest. If it was an elective contest, then all of the form letters sponsored by the timber industry would have swayed us to make the wilderness smaller. In fact, we discount and we do it before we ever get them. We tell people that. You can sign form letters, but it is not what we're looking for. We're looking for expressions of feeling. It's okay to say, I love the place. And for a long time, the agencies were saying, we need facts. Well, you hired us to get facts. We ask the public or give the public the opportunity to give us expressions of how they feel. And, you know, if you have any real belief in the democratic process, the collective voice of the public we found to be pretty damn eloquent.
Well, let's put that now in the context of what Tom was saying a moment ago. If you take it outside of land that's already been set aside for public use and put it into a private ownership situation, I don't suppose that the mining company is going to invite me to submit my thoughts about how the mine ought to be used or not, or whether the mine ought to be dug at that particular point. And now we've got the question of how does the public out there respond to that kind of an interest. It may be safe, I'm not saying it is,
mm-hmm.
but it may be safe when you've got the Forest Service making a decision to listen just to the backpackers because the rest of us don't become involved in that. But it's very doubtful in my mind whether it's safe not to have some device for eliciting response from the public when you get questions of use of land in a significant fashion as digging a mine and extracting minerals.
Of course, you have that.
When it's prepped.
Yeah, you have that in all western states, virtually all timbered states in the United States, for timber operations on private land. And you have, in this state and in Oregon, a citizens board that decides through a public review process of how Weyerhaeuser and all the rest of the private owners will cut their timber because the consequences of their harvest affect you. And in many, many ways. Air, water, soil, and wildlife. And so every state has a system, just as they do in Wisconsin for minerals, I'm sure they do for timber also. And so it is not unusual in this United States for natural resources on private land to have public supervision of the actions in effect through state laws. So it's not unique.
I could change it a little bit, maybe get it away from minerals. Because I think, I'm particularly interested in being involved in the nuclear energy arena. What do you do? Because it affects both the utility people that are trying to build, let's say, a power plant, and it affects the people environmentally, psychologically, and so on, if a power plant, nuclear power plant, happens to be anywhere near them. And it will affect us in the end, in our energy source. How, in a situation like that, I'll go back to what I talked about before. My impression with this whole process is that most of the public involved in that situation are ignorant. Their response isn't an educational response. It's an ignorant response. And a lot of times you have all kinds of fractions involved in it. And the consequences are enormous, I think. Consequences in the terms of what happened in Washington, the nuclear power plants. This happened throughout our country as a result of regulations, as a result of poor insight on the part of industry, and poor participation of the people in really telling the utilities that what they wanted, what they desired. And so, what do you do? How do you handle significant situations?
Anyone like to respond to that? I've got a test that I think, yes, sir.
If I'd like to respond to it, talking about not knowing the facts there or being uninformed and that, you know, affecting the decision. Well, perhaps it was a little bit, but you know, it was the accident at Three Mile Island and Chernobyl that I don't think there was a person alive that didn't know about that. And now you're saying, well, maybe they don't know all of the facts or those facts are exaggerated and they're making emotional decisions. I don't know. Those are the facts I'm basing my decision on. It says, right now, nuclear power is not safe enough. And I don't care how many facts you throw at me that it is, it can cut oil down. Based on Three Mile Island and what's happening over there, with that, it's just not safe enough yet. Well, you know, I'll go with coal-fired furnaces and oil and the other resources. And that, so my decision isn't ignorant or not based on information. I feel it's based on the fact that there's been some serious, real problems. Now, I think it's your job to sell me otherwise if you want to put a nuclear power plant next door to my house.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like there's a question of facts, not only with regard to the nuclear power plant, but a balancing where we're going to get our fuel. Because it's easy for people to say, hey, I don't want that coal plant in my backyard, and I don't want the nuclear plant in my backyard, and don't drill too close to me, and we can't, solar fuel is not economical, it takes up too much space, and we don't have the technology for it. Pretty soon, we don't have, our light bills are going up, and we're complaining about that, and we don't have the energy to achieve many of our goals for our children or our schools, and et cetera. There's some tough choices that are gonna have to be made. And from my standpoint, we have a lot of information that you passed right over, that you may know about it, with regard to coal and with regard to burning coal in terms of the death rate, the pollution count, the chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and emphysema, and lung disease, as well as the coal miners. Tremendous amount of death that, you know, is in the hundreds of thousands per year already happening. That number hasn't even come a fraction close with regard to nuclear power. So I look at this balance, and boy, I don't want nuclear power in my backyard either. I mean, I don't think any of us want those plants in our backyard. But the public, and we are part of them, requires power. We're going to have to make choices about which are the ones that are cleanest. Nuclear power is certainly a frightening and a catastrophic potential, but coal power is catastrophic year by after year after year, and we've just accepted it as part of our death rate now in our country, and it's just incorporated into our statistics. It's no longer separated out as a source, and I think if we were to really look at the comparison between nuclear power and coal, we come out very strongly in favor of nuclear power, and yet the emotional aspects of it and the catastrophe consciousness surrounding it is what frightens us more than the actual number of people killed or injured by it. There's been really few.
And that was precisely what I was trying to get at. I really appreciate your input, because in fact it is ignorance. It is the fact that a lot of the scientific energy related issues and a lot of the other issues is a result of not realizing what the whole situation is. You see one aspect of it, and you don't realize it partly because there are companies that don't want you to see it in our country. But I would say mostly just because we accept driving the automobile, for example, and don't think about the consequences of doing that. We get used to it. I appreciate both of
you. Suppose both of you people do hold the position that you've expressed after you've thought about it. Who would you want to know about it? And how would you go about somehow or other making an impact on the decision-making process? I've got
Forest Service fellow over here and a geological survey man from Wisconsin over here. And I'm afraid that they're out there making decisions without hearing from either one of you.
Well, I think for the most part, I would agree with Nick there that federally, if you're dealing with federal resources, there's a pretty good process for including public, whether they use it or not. Who knows for sure. But if you're dealing with private, and you mentioned about the Coalition of Washington, I would suggest that's probably a farce. From what I read in your papers and the old growth issues and everything else, I don't think people, the general public, has any influence on private industry whatsoever. That's a profit motive driven decision there constantly. What they're logging some island and they can't get them to stop that right up to people's house lines and stuff, so I don't know that they have any influence.
The question is, it seems to me, is what public involvement should be involved in the decision by a company?
Oh yeah, I'm agreeing. I'm not sure there should be. I mean, they own it. It's their resource. Unless it's going to probably really hurt or harm someone, like a mining thing. If you're going to put toxic waste in this creek and it's going to go down to Lake Chelan, you as a private company shouldn't have that right to do, whether you're on private or public land.
And to the extent that the public involves itself in that decision and does so, I would suggest from a technical perspective that is technically sound, then that public input is valuable. To the extent that they involve themselves in that system, in that decision, and say, I don't think we need all these mines, or I don't want that there. That happens to be my wilderness.
Yeah, that's immaterial.
And I think that's ineffective public input.
Well, it's not ineffective. It's irrelevant. If the mine is profitable and can operate, that's their business. Just like timber companies are logging their land, it's obviously profitable. Whether I have a feeling they should log it or not is irrelevant. Their land.
I think it is. Let me try you. Have you ever been to Damage Lake just over the ridge here?
No.
Or seen the pictures of some shown here recently? In the heart of this 460,000 acre Glacier Peak Wilderness, there is a privately owned copper mine, potentially, which has been assayed by a major company to exceed the load that was marketed here at Holden. The company has not chosen to enter to this date. Every time that any suggestion that they might, there is a major public involvement, unsolicited. You are telling me that you think in the heart of a nationally owned, citizen-owned wilderness, that the company that currently owns, I think it's Kennecott, currently owns that patented land, should be able to mine it?
Patented now means private
means
owned.
Privately owned. Yeah. Ownership is passed to the company because they have proven that it is a economically operable body of ore.
Yes. My input to those decisions, the option has been precluded. That was made when they made that and that land was done and patented that. I'm out of it. That was a decision somebody made a long time ago that I'm influenced by, just like right now when I look out across Holden.
But you didn't want them to put toxic waste in this crib.
Well, and up to that point, you'd still have to say, if they go in there and they want to open that copper mine, there are going to be certain state environmental laws that they have to meet that as a general person.
How about federal laws?
And federal laws, whatever. But as far as them mining there and ruining the visual right in the heart of it, that decision was made by somebody long ago. That's history.
What is stopped?
Public opinion.
I doubt it's probably price.
Public opinion has stopped every single effort to mine in wilderness in the Northwest.
If the price gets high enough, it won't.
We'll see. In the case of the Three Sisters, it was pummy, easily accessible, would not have had a major impact on the wilderness, patented land, and when the shouting was over, the senators from the state of Oregon had the citizens of the United States buy the rights.
And it was a public, but see, that's a political decision.
Of course it's political,
yeah, it's
but political decisions are people.
Well,
that's what will happen here, by the way.
They made money on it.
My prediction is, no way to challenge, but this body of ore would never have been mined if action was initiated after 1970 by the company. And therefore there would have been no Holden Village.
How many of you have been hearing the little thing on TV, radio that I have in the last couple of weeks? Comes on with some lady being terribly worried about the fact that her children in the state of Washington may not get a good education because the logging industry is going to be limited in the number of logs that it can cut. And of course, cutting timber on state land pays money for school education. And if that can't happen, why, the schools are going to fall down and their kids are going to not, won't learn how to read and write. And somehow or other, I have the feeling every time I hear that, that I'm being softened up in public opinion. You heard that ad?
No, but you better not move to Idaho then.
And I wonder if that can happen even with the mining industry.
If you don't think industries have major concern about their image in the utilization of natural resources, any of you that watched the Winter Olympics, anybody? Remember the Weyerhaeuser commercial that showed how much George loves deer? That cost $15 million, folks.
Whoa.
That's how important it is to George Weyerhaeuser that the people of the United States who don't own this corporation unless they own stock understand that the Weyerhaeuser timber practices respect wildlife. And in fact, I can tell you they do. But it's worth $15 million to George Weyerhaeuser to send that message to an international audience.
How much old growth is he willing to leave grow on his land, and how much is he willing to allow grow on the rest of the national forest in Washington?
Well, Weyerhaeuser is not a good case in the latter part of the question because they're not a purchaser of national forest because they're an exporter and they
okay,
can't.
But take it for
but they have no intention of retaining old growth on their land. They will and have retained habitat for eagles, but that's not a major commitment of old growth.
Okay, well, let's take a threatened endangered species like the spotted owl, or well, I know it's a sensitive species or whatever.
Yes.
You know, would they be willing to set aside pieces of their, large chunks of their land?
No, of course they would not. They expect that to be done by the public ownership, and they believe, I don't speak for Weyerhaeuser, obviously, but I suspect the position of the industry has been told to be so. Their belief is that there is adequate supply of old growth already retained in the 25% of the national forests in this region that are in wilderness. And that is arguable. It's also strongly arguable that the spotted owl is not an indicator species for old growth on the east side of the mountains. Because in fact, in this forest, we have more pears in non-old growth stands than we do in old growth stands. And that's very traceable to fire in the ecosystem, which nobody's talked about. But the spotted owl is not an issue. Spotted owl is a surrogate.
Right.
You are exactly correct. Old growth is the issue. We should talk intelligently about that. And that's what we're trying to do when we deal with that issue, to broaden it to what its true scope and scale is. And we find the public willing to hear and learn and listen. If we're willing, you know, to go through an education process, which I think we're paid to do. Once we got by that we're scientists, we know best attitude. See, that doesn't stimulate good communications.
But when you say that about the commercial, really believe, I didn't see it, but if I saw that commercial, the first thing that would come to my mind is that they're wanting us to feel good about them.
Oh, of course.
Regardless
yeah.
of whether, I mean, that's like putting a little bait wrapped in a blanket and go, ooh, ah, you know.
Well, certainly.
And so it's kind of a new, commercial, whether or not they really believe it, it's worth them to pay $15 million and write it off somehow in advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know, but, you know, as a consumer, I look at all advertising now. Well,
see,
I mean,
you probably don't, because if...
I mean, I think the next time I see Weyerhaeuser anywhere, I mean, I don't look at lumber, but I'm going to kind of have a hoo-ah feeling about them.
Well, that's, of course, what they want you to have, you know.
Well,
Tom and I are used to this. If anyone wants to get the public to embrace a natural resource cause, they always turn to wildlife. Because, you know, a lot of people like clean water, and a lot of people like standing forests, and a lot of people like the soil to stay in place, but everybody loves Bambi.
Yeah.
Yeah, bottom line. And so animals always become the surrogate for other issues, whether it's mining or whatever. It's fish in streams,
yeah.
It's endangered species.
Or it's a life insurance.
Yeah, the whole concept of endangered species is strange. What if we'd have had an Endangered Species Act when the pterodactyl was flying around?
A while ago, Dick said that he was happy that we did not have an elective process which would determine questions about this. I assume the reason for that is...
I don't like the results of the elections I see.
Because the electorate is not informed.
Well, it is because we don't choose to inform. Okay? when we go to an election, all we do is count numbers, so we go out to get numbers. Instead of trying to inform the public, I try to convince them that I had the right answer.
Yeah.
I'd probably take George's approach. Say, I'd run a $15 million commercial on whatever we thought was the best alternative for management of the forests in Region 6. That's why I don't like it. Because John Ware wouldn't have got the 80 acres of Altruis Lake into the Alpine Lakes because he wouldn't have enough voters. He didn't need any. He only needed his own good, sound recommendations. See, and that's why quality, if the agency listens and cares to listen, then quality responses over top numbers. I think that's a democratic process.
You know, we're from the Midwest, and we aren't too involved in this forestry out here, except we might have a little article about this pig in our paper. And now we see where the Sierra Club is fighting this or fighting that, so I've always felt the Sierra Club is representing me, although I don't belong to them, because they sound like they got a good idea of protecting the environment.
You make a good point. The majority of the people that support wilderness never see one. That's well established. The majority of the support to the Wilderness Society and the Sierra Club nationally comes from people that are not participants in outdoor recreation or wilderness recreciation.
Seems to me that I recall
it's a value system.
Are they good, or are they just a political arm, or what?
I can't make a value judgment about them. They spend money to support them. People spend money to support
Holden
that never come
opinion?
Here.
Pardon? Do they sway your opinion with their figures?
Well, the figures don't, but the expressions do. We look for substance. Numbers
issue,
don't.
I think. Sometimes they can be very effective.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're just not effective at all. Depends on the position that they want to take and how they want to approach the decision.
I have this feeling in the bottom of my stomach that Weyerhaeuser Lumber Company moved out here after they got through cutting all of your timber away.
In Iowa?
Did you say Iowa?
No, Illinois.
Oh, Illinois.
We go up to Bagley, Wisconsin. He probably knows where that is. And I said to this one old guy, I said, I can just see those Indians sneaking through those trees. He said, when I was a kid, he said, there wasn't a tree on those hills. He said, they was all cut bare.
By the way, there are more forested acres in New York now than there were 50 years ago, just for the record. There are more deer in Pennsylvania than around the state of Washington. So don't make any real quick judgments about what's going on with natural resources in the United States, because you could be wrong.
We've got time for just a couple more comments, then we got to quit. Yeah.
I may be starting off too much of a new subject, but let me just throw it out and see if there's any way we can address it at all. Just with regard to this other gentleman's question and the conversation about nuclear power versus coal versus steel, I'm seeing a different but a similar type of value comparison. And this one is love of wildlife, the love of standing forest and old growth and clean water. In atomic energy versus coal power and other kinds of power, it's really public health is the value rather than the value of clean water or standing forest. And so I'm wondering about the public health process in getting the information out to people. Because I see, you know, the anti-nuclear arm is very powerful, very persuasive, and has me, you know, terrified, even though I'm a scientist and know, you know, as much as can be known, I think, these days, about relative risk there and recognize that there is some real relative risk, but also know what the coal power situation is. But where is there an agency other than health, education, and welfare, which seems far less accessible than the forestry department, for informing public about decisions with regard to industry? Because this crosses the line of energy resources and utilities and public health. So how do you have impact into that?
Big shot at
informing people.
Well, I would say one thing that strikes me is that your regulations are a surrogate for concern about public health, because generally they grow out of information that particular practices or releases into the environment that affect public health. In my experience, I've never seen a public health agency be an effective participant in these decisions, and really you're relying only on regulations. I shouldn't say only, but you are relying on regulations as a surrogate for concern about public health. I don't know if that's your experience or not.
That is, but I would guess also that, you know, we've talked about ignorance in the people, and I maintain that I find a great deal of intelligence when we listen, but foolishness I'll buy into quickly. You want to talk about public health? You want to talk about death in the United States? We collectively, as a citizenry of this country, gave up safety at 55 to drive 65, bottom line. And we are so bad, and every police department in the United States has told us and told us again and furnished us to the statistics, and the insurance companies have said you can drive 65 at an increased cost because more people will die. And we said, it's worth it. Didn't we?
I think there's quite a bit of truth in that. We have arrived at 10 o'clock. Before we close, I want to make the observation that Dick has done something tonight that I didn't think I was going to see. He's almost got me trusting government. That's quite a job. You're to be commended. Thank you all for being here.